Who wants to share a trait or a characteristic or a mannerism that you picked up from your mom, Jolynn?
Wait, what?
Sorry, I was talking.
Share. I don't even know, but I've been told that there are times when I'm turning into my mother, which I really don't look at. In a good way? I mean, it's usually pointed out when I am being annoying, so. But I'm sure there's many.
Helpful? Okay.
Yeah, helpful.
Someone else? Mark?
Cooking?
Yeah, your mom liked to cook?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
His mom makes a mean chocolate cake.
Oh.
Like from scratch? But it's like one of those ones you see out of like.
Pollyanna cake.
Yeah, like it's bigger than most.
Well.
It's like crazy.
Definitely
cool.
Chocolate.
Someone else?
My mom's like the catalyst. I don't know if everyone's got someone in their family.
Mm-hmm.
You think about like when you said, what's your favorite meal? And that's like, I'm 48 years old and I've never had a bad Thanksgiving, a bad Christmas. So if my mom was gone, it's like she's a catalyst that holds everybody together.
Okay.
So I guess I could be a catalyst trying to hold things together, I guess.
Oh, that's cool. One or two more?
Says things unfiltered. I forgot that they met my mom at my housewarming party.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, "Ooh, they do know my mom."
Yeah,
I think I don't think before. Well, actually, I think before I speak, I just say what everybody else won't.
Yeah.
And so does she.
50% of the time, that's a good strategy.
I would say 70.
70-30.
Still married, though.
There you go. One more person. Guy.
Damn.
Just made me a great person, and to try to help people, help solve problems, and make sure that. Me and my family are going in a good direction, so.
Amen.
That's all I have for now.
Well, we're going to talk about a little bit about mothers this morning. The mother we're going to talk about is Rebecca, and Rebecca has an interesting relationship. One of the things we'll hone in on is a relationship with her son, Jacob. And she has actually two sons. She has twin boys. She has a son, Jacob, and a son, Esau. And so we're going to talk about this mother, Rebecca, and kind of the relationship she has with her boys, and I want to look at this narrative this morning. But as we've been talking about this woman of the Old Testament series, one of the things we've been doing is we've been saying, hey, let's have women share about their perspective from this narrative. So this morning I'd like to ask my good friend Donna Braden to come up front, but if Donna Braden would not like to come up front, we love Donna and would receive her word from her chair where she is right now. And Donna, she brought me these, so these are, I think this is her contribution to the picnic this afternoon.
Yeah.
Salt and vinegar crickets.
Oh my gosh.
Crickets are good luck, right?
And she says that crickets are good luck?
I think when they're alive, though.
So you want to eat them when they're alive, or you want to eat them when they're...
Now, on the back is a chart to show you all the different pieces of the cricket that you can enjoy.
Yeah, there's the rump, there's the flank, the drumstick, the breast, and the wings. And these are right out of Grover Beach, California, so right up the road. They're salting up crickets and...
Grover.
I kept the bacon and cheddar because I haven't tried that kind yet.
So I don't know if this is giving Donna more credibility at the moment or less credibility.
No, remember on Shark Tank, there was a company was saying how sustainable it is and easy it is to reproduce crickets versus and how they're a good source of protein and they mix them in different...
I don't know. For one cricket, you're going to get 0.67 of a gram of protein, which is 1%. Well, this is all so the whole box of crickets here, you're going to get 0.67 grams of protein. I don't know what they're selling. I'm not eating a bunch of crickets for 0.67 grams of protein. Okay, that
what's the serving size?
Muscle milk has
1 gram.
Serving size, one per hit, or?
Yeah, this serving size is one, and servings per container is one. So this is 0.6. For this whole, you got to eat this whole box of crickets for 0.67 grams of protein. Or you can just go have some muscle milk or a protein shake and get about 25 grams. Donna, we are way off topic talking about crickets. Here we go. I don't know how we got.
That was my plan.
We've been distracted past you long enough, so.
I was going to save the crickets for last, but.
Oh, did I remember? Really?
No, that's fine. All right. I'm going to slide right off of that. I'm not going to try doing that. I'm so glad that I consider you guys friends. I don't think I could get up here, but I didn't think that. So, Rebecca, in a nutshell. It's kind of funny to me. I was so upset with my own daughter when she decided to pierce her own nose. And then in the beginning, the story of Rebecca, when Abraham's servant goes to find Isaac a wife, Abraham sends his servant back to his birthplace. And so the servant, I'm getting off topic, sorry. The servant, you'll get what I'm getting at in a second. The servant goes and says a prayer to God and asks God to, you know, help him find the right woman for Isaac. I was going to do it without papers. anyways. So he goes to the birthplace of Abraham, and he's at the well, and he devises a plan where he's going to ask somebody for water, and whoever is generous and offers to give him water and his camels and everybody who's with them, then that'll be the woman he chooses. And so pretty much right at the same time he's done praying, maybe even before he was done praying, here comes Rebecca. And sure enough, she offers to give him water and to water his camels and keeps drawing water out of the well until everyone's had their fill. And then tells her of the reason why he's there. And he gives her a gold nose ring and a couple of gold bracelets. And he puts one of the stories I read was he puts the gold nose ring in her nose. So me imagining that was kind of funny. And then it brought me back to my daughter and her piercing her own nose. I didn't know it was such a common thing in the Old Testament. So she gets all, Rebecca gets all excited about the nose ring and the bracelets and runs back and tells her family about it, tells her mom and her brother. And then the brother comes out and he brings the servant in, and the servant tells the family of the about Abraham and his wish for the servant to find him a bride or find a bride for Isaac. And then they say, okay, she can go with you, but we want her to stay here with us for a little while. And the servant says, no, I think that, it's really a good idea if we go now. And then they decided to leave it up to Rebecca. And I think Rebecca was probably only about 14, 15 at the time. It was really hard for me to tell. There was so many different opinions on how old she was. So I'm not quite sure. But anyway, so they get the blessing, that they give Rebecca a blessing, and they send her off with her nurse and the servant and all his men, and they all go back. And now she's coming up to her new homeland, and she sees this guy off in the fields, and he's out there, and he's meditating, and he's praying, and this kind of impresses her. So she inquires, who's this guy out there? And then she's told that this is Isaac, and this is, to be her husband. She gets excited to meet him, and she fixes herself up and puts her veil on, and goes to meet him, and they get married, and they have about a 20-year period where it's just the two of them, and they both keep praying for God to bless them with children, and And so Rebecca finally gets pregnant, and it's a horrible, difficult pregnancy. And, you know, there's no ultrasounds or anything like that. So, you know, how would you know that you're having twins or, you know. So she doesn't know any of this, and she just knows she's having a lot of problems with the pregnancy. And so she's told to pray about it. So she prays, and God tells her that in her womb, she's birthing two nations, and that the younger is going to serve the older. She kind of didn't, I don't think she really understood what that meant at that time, but this was God's promise that for her to, you know, that she was going to have these two sons, and sure enough she did, and she had Esau and Jacob. And Esau was big and strong, and Jacob was smaller. I picture him as, you know, just kind of like a scrawny little guy. Anyway, so now the kids are, the babies are born, and Isaac favors Esau, and Rebecca favors Jacob. And part of me thinks that maybe she favored Jacob because she saw all the attention that the big, strong baby was getting, but the little guy, the little runt of the litter, you know, was just maybe not getting the attention from his dad that Asa got. And that was my perspective, is from a mom thing. Anyway, so I think that's why she showed so much favoritism to Jacob, because she didn't want Asa getting all the attention. Anyway, so the boys grow up. And Isaac's getting on in years now. He's getting, he feels as though he's getting closer to death. He's blind now, or almost blind. And I left something out. Jacob gets Esau to hand over his birthright to him over a bowl of lentils. And Esau is so hungry that he agrees and says, fine, I'll give you my birthright. But I don't think that Rebecca knew this. So I think she's in her head, she's still thinking, well, God has promised that Jacob will, that Esau will serve Jacob. And so I think she's starting to panic now because the dad's getting older. And when is God's promise going to come to pass? You know, we're running out of time. I have to hurry up and step in here and do something. But the birthright had already been passed, and now it's time for the blessing. And So Rebecca finds out that Isaac is going to give the blessing to Esau, and she devises a plan to trick him. And she has Jacob go and get some goats, and she cooks them up for Isaac and makes bread and wine and the whole nine yards. And then Jacob says, no, it's not going to work. He's not going to believe that I'm Esau. It doesn't matter if he's losing his eyesight or not. He's never going to believe it. So she devises another plan where she's going to take the goat skin and put it on his arms and his neck and, you know, make him smell and feel like Esau. So it works. He comes in. Jacob gets the blessing from his father. And then Esau comes in right after, and Esau finds out, and he's really upset. Now he wants to kill Jacob. And Rebecca, who already didn't wait for God's timing and push push God's plan to happen before it was supposed to, I think. And so now because of this, now Jacob's in danger, and nobody knows that Rebecca did this, but they just they know that they were deceived. So Rebecca devises another plan to get Jacob out of the land so that he could be safe and nothing will happen to him. So she goes to Isaac and she says, listen, Asa's married to these horrible Canaanite women and they bring us nothing but hardship and bad things come to us. So can we please send Jacob away so he can find a wife from our homeland? So he sends Jacob and to go find a wife, and that keeps Jacob safe. Well, now while Jacob's gone, it doesn't mention Rebecca's death in the Bible, but while Jacob's gone, I believe that Rebecca dies. And when he comes back, everything works out well for Jacob and Esau, and God's promise comes to pass, but it didn't work out very well for Rebecca, who like pushed, tried to force God's plan to happen on her own timing instead of his timing. And I wonder if her punishment for not fully trusting and believing God was that she still got to see that God's promise came to pass, but she never got to see her beloved son, who she treasured so much, again. And was left with a lot of heartache and sadness. And I wonder what would have happened if she would have waited and trusted God 100% and that he was going to fulfill his promise on his timing. And I know I'm really guilty of not doing things on God's timing. I want to push things forward. I want them to happen now, now, now. And so sometimes they don't work out the way I planned, but it's got to be the way he plans. So for me, I really enjoyed reading about Rebecca and learning more about her, but I think her whole problem was that she didn't wait for God's timing. And she tried to make everything happen according to her will. So,
I don't know. Donna? Good luck, Donna. Couple things here, and Donna, you did such a wonderful job recapping the story of this whole kind of mess here. And you have, I would say, the way, if you have a Bible and you want to turn to Genesis, we're going to start in Genesis 24. And if somebody wants to shout out a page, you can do that. But the kind of outline of this whole passage goes a little bit like this. In Genesis 24, Donna, as you shared, you have this just stunning chapter of detailing the way that Rebecca becomes Isaac's wife. And it's a beautiful, beautiful narrative. One of my more beautiful passages in the Old Testament of this kind of husband and wife coming together and all the twists and turns that go that way. In Genesis 25, you read the narrative of Rebecca. She has twin boys, Jacob, and then right after the boys are born, it kind of skips a little bit, and then you have Jacob, this younger boy, the mama's boy, the kid that kind of hangs around the house in the tents. He buys the birthright from the older, and I'll explain that, some of those kind of things that happened in there. And then in Genesis 27, Rebecca helps Jacob steal Esau's blessing from Isaac. Now, I want to kind of walk through this a little bit, but just so we all know where we are in the story, it's because all these Old Testament names that we're not familiar with can get a little tricky. Last week we talked about Abraham, and then we talked about that relationship between Hagar and Sarah. And Sarah was the one that God had promised, like, hey, you're going to have a kid. And there was that 20-year promise. And Sarah says, no, sleep with my handmaiden, my servant. And remember, they have the son Ishmael. But God promises that the blessing or the bloodline is going to go through this relationship, Abraham and Sarah. So then you have Isaac. You have Isaac the son. And the story picks up at Genesis 24, where Abraham is looking for a wife for Isaac, right? So Abraham, calls his servant Eliezer, and he's looking for a wife for this young man, Isaac. Okay? So you have Abraham and Isaac, and then we're going to talk about that relationship between Isaac and Rebekah. And I'm always, there we go, page question mark. Anybody got a page number? 16. I'm always like kind of wondering kind of where we are. So here's, I drew this week. I just free-handed this. I just whipped it up in my spare time. So again, Abraham kind of comes from this land, the land of Haran, and God says, go, I'm going to give you this new land. I'm going to give you the land of Canaan down here. So Abraham's kind of living down here. But Abraham says, I don't want my son Isaac. I don't want him marrying a woman from here. I want him to marry a woman from our tribe up here. So he sends his servant, the guy's name is Eliezer, right? He sends his servant up to this land called Haran to go find a wife for his son. Everybody with me so far? Now, there's this great verse. Somebody read Genesis 24, too.
It says, he said to the senior servant in his household, the one in charge of all that he had, put your hand under my thigh.
So the way that he gets the servant to make this promise is he says, put your hand under my thigh. Now, does anybody kind of read that and be like, wait a second, like how far under your thigh? Like, what far with that? Are we talking like down here? Like we can roll with that, you know what I mean? But where are you talking about hand under my thigh? What's this all about? Now, if you look at this and you study it, one of the things I found was fascinating and a bit disturbing, but it makes sense, is actually what Abraham says to his servant, right? Because Abraham says to his servant, promise me that you won't find a woman. Promise me that you won't find a woman for me here. Go up here and promise that you'll find a woman for my tribe and for my clan. Promise me that. And what this servant does is deal. You know what I mean? This isn't like the handshake. What most commentators would say is that hand under the thigh would be like a euphemism for, we're going to go like to the PG-13. Olivia, you might want to close your ears. Put your hand on my, well, we have kids in here. Okay. Can we fill in the blank?
Yeah.
Put your hand there,
yeah.
Okay? Now, you're thinking like, oh, that gets even weirder. No, the Bible's just weird, so we can just start there. God gave Abraham the promise of this bloodline, right? And he says, and here's how we're going to keep this promise, is through circumcision. Remember that, right? The promise is done through circumcision. So when he says to his servant Eliezer, he says, when you put your hand here, it was almost as if they were kind of confirming that promise that God says that this is what's going to happen. Now, again, the Old Testament, the Bible's weird, and they just do some weird stuff, and we kind of look back and like, I'm not making that kind of a handshake. I don't know what kind of handshake. But it makes sense that it's this beautiful picture of saying, I want you to find, we're gonna do this the right way. We're going to do this the covenant way. We're going to do this the promised way, and we're going to kind of confirm that. Okay, so Eliezer, Don, as you shared, and you did such a good job recapping, Eliezer goes up to this land and he prays to the Lord and he says, Lord, he says, if a woman comes carrying a penguin, I'll never forget that. If she comes carrying a penguin, if a woman comes carrying a jar of water and offers me water, that will be the wife, that will be the one for Isaac. And so this, before he's done praying, I was reading this, I was like, man, that guy's got like some prayer power. This guy's got it going on, right? He's praying and he's not even done praying. The Lord's bringing women his way. And before he's done praying, this woman comes up and says, hey, do you want some water? Or can I have, you know, they have this relationship. And so she says, yeah, but not only will I give you water, but I'll give your camels water. Now he's traveling with 10 camels. And I'm thinking to myself, well, how much water does a camel drink? Anybody think about that? Who knows how much water a camel drinks?
A lot for a week.
Huh?
Enough for a week?
A lot.
A lot of water. Do you know how much? 30 gallons a camel would drink. 10 camels. Do the math. How many gallons of water is that? 300 gallons of, there's 300 gallons of water right there. Rebecca is doing some work on this thing. I wish Nathan was here. I got this great story about Nathan. This was a couple months ago. you know, we got all our little 5 gallons here, and we put them here, and we use them for water and whatnot. And I think a couple months ago, we only had 3 of them, right? We had these 3, and we accumulated a few more. And I said, hey, Nathan, you know, can you go over to Rite Aid right there, and can you fill up the waters? They have that little water dispenser. It's $1.25. You put the money in, dispenses the water. He's like, yeah, sure, I'll take care of it. And then I kind of went about my way, and I was doing setting up and making coffee, and, you know, we were doing all these things. And we were sitting out on the patio. We were praying. And then all of a sudden, Nathan comes walking back. And Nathan, so I'm going to just pick up the empty one. Nathan is carrying water on his shoulder. And I'm looking at him like what's he doing? And then he puts it down, and he walks back, and he goes and gets another one. And he had walked over there with 3 empty jugs of water and carried them back. And I said, you didn't take your car? And I wish he was here because we would have a good laugh at it. But he just didn't think that, you know, hey, I'm going to walk over there with 3 empties and I'm going to have to carry 3 fulls back. And so he was like, is it Froggy? You know, when you kind of like put one down, you go back, pick up another one, put it here, and you go back and pick up another one. And then he just frogged these, you know, 15 gallons of water. And I'm thinking about Rebecca, and I was like, Nathan, Rebecca could become your patron saint of water filling up. But she's a hard worker, right? Then Eleazar meets with the brothers. They put the ring in her nose. They give her the gold bracelet, and she welcomes them into the home, into their camp, to their tribe. And it's this beautiful story. I mean, it's a beautiful story where she eventually comes home with Eleazar to go marry Isaac, right? And at the very end, let's go to the very end of Genesis 24. Go to, let's pick it up in, I think, 66. Genesis 24, 60, let's go to Genesis 24, 64. 24, 64. So that's still on page 8? I'm sorry, 16. She's coming back. So again, if we're to look at, she's coming back here from Haran, kind of where her tribe was, and she's coming back to meet Isaac. She looked up, and this is verse 64, she looks up and she sees Isaac. She got down from her camel, which she had watered, so she earned that, and said to the servant, who is this man in the field coming to meet us? So she sees Isaac from afar, and she says, who is this guy? And Eleazar, he's my master, the servant answered. So she took her veil and covered herself. And then this beautiful verse 66 and 67, then the servant told Isaac all he had done. Isaac brought her into the tent of his mother Sarah, and he married Rebekah. So she became his wife, and he loved her, and Isaac was comforted after his mother's death. This beautiful end to this birth narrative. Some great things that I think we pick up in this first part of the narrative is that we understand that Rebekah is a very hard worker. Again, I just go back to this picture. She watered 10 camels. Now, that takes some work, right? Nathan would be very proud of Rebekah for watering 10 camels. That's a lot of work to water that. She's a hard worker. We find her as hospitable in 24:25. In 24:25, she welcomes. She says, hey, Eleazar, bring your camels, bring your everything, your whole traveling circus. Come, we welcome you into our tribe. We welcome you into our village. We welcome you into our tent. She welcomes them in. In 24:58, they make this deal. They arrange this deal for Rebekah to be Isaac's wife. But they say, hey, we want to just spend some more time with Rebekah before she goes. And the servant Eleazar is like, no offense, but I really don't want to hang around here for a long time. Can she just kind of come right now? And again, Donnie said she's probably 14, 15 years old. She's a young woman. And she says, okay, let's go. She's comforting, again, that beautiful verse at the very end, where she comforts Isaac after his mother's death. So you have all these beautiful pictures of Rebekah. Now, what happens is, I would say this, that even though this story is incredibly inspiring, we could spend some time talking about all these traits, but there's a temptation in churches to just teach morality, okay? There's a temptation for me just to kind of stand up here and talk about good morals to you. And I don't want to do that. I want to talk about something different. And I think that something else picks up in the story. Now, part 2, hold that for a second, okay? Part 2, you have the twin boys. I just forgot to put the page numbers in. Probably 16 again, 17. You have the twin boys. So in chapter 25, you have these twin boys that are jostling around in her womb. And again, Donna, you said it's a difficult pregnancy. It's a hard pregnancy for her. And these two little babies are jostling around in her womb. And the Lord says to her, she goes to inquire the Lord. She goes, so another thing we pick up is she's a prayerful woman. She goes to say, hey, Lord, what's going on here? What's going on in my belly? Why is all these things happening? And she goes to inquire on the Lord. And the Lord says that the older will serve the younger, right? Now, in the ancient Near East, that didn't happen. The older was the head of the household. He would have the birthright. He'd have the blessing. And all the younger children would answer to the older child, right? And this is kind of still similar to today, right? Where the oldest child, for the most part, might be the executor of the will. They might kind of have the make the decisions for the children after the parents pass away. We kind of still have that hierarchy set up for the most part. In the ancient Near East, it was probably a little bit more rigid. But God says that the older Esau, right, is going to be end up serving the younger boy. And again, Esau, we get this picture of like kind of a man's man, right? He's hairy, he's muscular, he's a hunter, he's, you know, out there kind of doing all this man stuff. And you kind of have this image of Jacob where he kind of hangs around the tent. He was scrawny. I mean, you just kind of have this picture. He's scrawny. I put up, you know, that Esau is skillful with the bow and arrow, and Jacob is skillful with the bowl and ladle. Thank you. Thank you. That was all week long. I figured out how to make that. But you know what I mean? And I don't know, like, I guess some guys, it's like, man, I want to be like the bow and arrow dude. I want to be out there. You know what I mean? But what happens then, right after these two boys are born, right? Then again, Esau comes out first. He's the oldest. Then Jacob comes out. And right after, in chapter 25, if you go to 25, if you go to 25, say 29, Esau's out hunting. He comes home and he's starving. He's famished. And he says, quick, some of that stew that you've made, that lentil stew, that delicious lentil stew, give me some of that. I'm about ready to die. Now, this kind of sounds a little bit like exaggeration to me. I don't know quite. But he's like, oh, I just need. And Jacob says to him, what does Jacob say? Sure, man, you're my brother. I'd love to give you some of my stew, right? Sure, absolutely. Isn't that like what you'd want your kids to do? He says, no. Sell me your birthright, right? Give me your birthright. Now, the birthright, as I put up here, entitles you to double of the inheritance. So if there's two kids, the oldest gets 2/3 and the younger gets 1/3. Robin, real quick, how would that get divided if there was three kids? Come on, math majors. Three kids. The first would get double. There it is, right there. A half. 20, a half. So the oldest would, if there's three children, the oldest would get a half. And then the second would get 25, and the third would get 25. Okay? Anybody want to go to the next level? Four kids? 40, 20, 20. So anyway, so he says, give me your birthright. Now, again, if you were Bill Gates' son, and you were starving, or what's happening, and somebody says, quick, sell it to me for a can of Campbell's soup. Right? I mean, this is what happens in this story. And it's kind of this weird narrative where like, you know, there must be a lot of tension between these brothers, a lot of issues between these brothers, that he would watch his brother almost starving to death and take advantage of him in that moment. It's not a pretty scene to me. It's kind of an ugly scene. You're stealing somebody's life for a can of Campbell's soup is what you're offering. Give me your birthright and I'll feed you. I'm about ready to die. What good is my birthright if I'm going to die? It doesn't matter, right? And so, I'll take that from you. And then at the end, at the very end there of chapter 25, Esau despises his birthright, right? I think there's other things that he despises. He probably despises his brother as well. But he despises his birthright. Chapter 27, we move here. And Isaac is old. and he needs to pass on his blessing. Now, let me distinguish between the two here, because there's two things going on. First off, the birthright is about inheritance, it's about economics, and it's about possessions, right? The blessing would be about honor, it would be about bloodline, it would be about head of the family. So he's already got this part. He already bought this for a can of soup, right? Now he's going after this guy right here. And Isaac is going to bless. He's going to say the bloodline, the head of the family is going to run through you, Esau. Rebekah hears about it, and she devises this plan, this, we'll say it what it is, this scheme, right? This fraud to get her son Jacob the blessing, okay? She cooks the food. She dresses Jacob in fine clothes. She puts the camel hair on him, right? At what point is Jacob saying, oh, that's a great idea, Mom, we should do this? And no, Mom's like saying, well, do this, do this, do this. And he's like, huh? And at one point, listen to this, in verse 12, if you look at 27:12, in verse 27:12, Jacob says this. He says, what if my dad touches me? If my I would appear to be tricking him and would bring down a curse on myself rather than a blessing. So he's like, man, I don't think this is a good idea. He's like, we're going to get found out, and I'm going to end up cursed rather than being blessed. He's objecting to her little scheme. And she says, my son, let the curse fall on me. Just do what I say and go get them for me. Right? Go get the stuff for me. Do what I say, son. And okay, so he went and gets them and brings them to his mother. So the plan works. In verse 27 through 29, we find out that Jacob ends up tricking his father, and his father puts this great blessing on him, and Esau comes in from the fields. Now, if Esau had just come in from the field hunting, what does he have with him? Food and weapons, right? And he finds out that he's not only sold his birthright, but he finds out that this has been stolen from him, and he's furious, and he's ready to kill his brother. And he says, I won't. One of the things he makes a commitment to, he's like, I'm not going to kill my brother when my father's still alive, but when Isaac passes away, after I've been done mourning him, I'm going to kill my brother. And this is, again, Rebekah overhears this, and she says, Jacob, you need to get out of here. And she sends him back up to that kind of original, kind of where his wife came, where she came from, that kind of land of Haran. Okay? Now, sorry, I missed these two. So Rebekah overhears Isaac. She devises a scheme for Jacob to steal a blessing from Esau. The fraud works. Once Esau finds out, he vows to kill her brother. Now here's the movements of this whole passage of Rebekah. She's married to Isaac. She has twin boys. Jacob hustles the birthright from Esau. And then, thank you for my laughs. There's a great film, but I don't know if it's great. I think I can recommend it. If you have HBO, there's a film on HBO about Bernie Madoff. Did you watch it yesterday? Whew, that is a wild story.
Here's the interesting too. If they're twins and one comes out just a second before the other, I never got that story. I mean, how is that one the birthright? You know what I mean?
First one out.
The same,
yep.
I know, but they're the same exact age. I
mean, no, he's
theoretically.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to be
like, I never do that. But even twins nowadays, they'll be like, no, I'm 2 minutes
older.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I just never, I thought they were separated by farther than that. They are twins. It's like they're fighting in the room. Who's coming out first?
This story, I call it Love and Lies because there's this beautiful story of love with her marriage, of her having these babies. And then the story kind of ends at the end with like, right? Who was this woman, Rebekah? What was she all about? And we kind of see her at the very beginning as hardworking, as flexible, as hospitable. We see her as prayerful at the beginning of chapter 25. And then I would say, for me, when you read 27, it's a hard pill to swallow. It's not easy, right? She's deceitful. She's scheming. She says, hey, I'll be cursed. I don't mind. And at the very end of it, like, she loses that relationship with her son. Now, when we approach this, and I had a hard time approaching this week because I'm like, okay, well, the wrong way I would say to approach this is to talk about morality. Again, remember I mentioned that at the very beginning, and about means justifying the ends. Okay? The story becomes very problematic when we try to approach it as a moral lesson, because you just can't do it like that. Go ahead and, you know, lie, cheat, and steal. And if it justifies the ends, it's all good, right? And see, what happens is, unfortunately, churches and pastors, we can often kind of just go to that realm, or just preach against it. Hey, don't lie, don't cheat, don't steal, don't do those things, and look at how bad her life ended, and all these. And if you approach it as that, to me, I think that's the wrong way to approach it. You know, my boy, Mr. Robert Capone, says, you know, people always assume that the church's primary business is to teach morality, but it isn't. It's to proclaim grace, forgiveness, and the free party for all. And so what I would say is this. I think a better way to approach it is this, and I only really have one word for you guys this morning, is Rebecca, when we see Rebecca in 27, she has a complete moral breakdown. She is a liar. She doesn't even appeal to God. There's not like, oh, Lord, you've promised me that the older is going to serve the younger. I have this promise from you. She doesn't appeal to the Lord. She overrides Jacob's plea for integrity. Jacob's like, I don't want to do this. I will end up cursed rather than blessed, right? And because of her deception, Jacob ends up on the run for his life. And I would say it's a total moral failure. It just completely falls apart towards the end. And the second question is, well, do the means, her lying, and here's my question. Here's a deep moral question. Do the means end up justifying the ends? What do you guys think?
Did she get justice?
God's plan was going to come to pass anyway. She just didn't trust God enough. She tried to make it happen herself.
But it worked. So what choice and what agency or choice do we have then? If it doesn't matter, Don, if you're saying what you're saying, kind of go do what you want to do.
Free will.
Okay. But if God's going to, the plan's going to happen anyway, right? Is it appropriate to be deceptive to accomplish the work of God? But this is what happens. This is what we get in the story. This is why you approach a story and you're like, oh man, this is kind of like a weird, kind of a funky finish, right? You know, when Paul talks about this in Romans 3, Paul gets accused about some of these things in Romans 3, and he has this great verse here in Romans 3 where he says this in Romans 3, 8b. He said, let us do evil that good may result. And these people are accusing Paul of kind of making this argument, of scheming this argument. Let us do evil that good may result. To me, this kind of encapsulates the story, this chapter 27 of Rebecca. The means justify the end. I did what I had to do to make this happen, right? Does anybody kind of like, the gears in your head are kind of slowly grinding to a halt, and you're like, I don't know what's going on here. So why not appeal? So again, there's all these questions to me that just, why not appeal to that? Why not appeal to the Lord? Lord, you've given me this promise. You know, instead she's like, hey, she's got this whole plan that she's got going on, right? So again, I think the problem with this, as you read this, is when you read it as morality, or when you read it as means justifying the end, or when you ask all these questions, you're in the wrong land. What I would say is we can approach it like this, and here's how I would approach it. Here's how I think we can approach it. We don't approach it as morality or means justifying the ends. We ask the question, how does this narrative point us to the good news of Jesus or the gospel, right? How does this point us towards the grace of the gospel? Paul, in chapter 3, and I wish I had time to go through all of Romans chapter 3, but he builds his argument in chapter 3 to where he gets to this point. Here's where he talks about in 21 through 26. This is a lot. He says, but for the good news, God's restorative justice has entered the world independent of the law. Both the law and the prophets told us this day would come. This redeeming justice comes through the faithfulness of Jesus, the anointed one, the liberating king, who makes salvation a reality for all who believe without the slightest partiality. You see, here's a great 3:23, all sinned and in their futile attempts to reach God and his glory fail, yet they are now saved and set right by his free gift of grace through the redemption available only in Jesus the anointed, right? I would say this, that if you were to kind of lay what I would say, because again, the Romans 3:8b, this kind of like, hey, let's just do evil because we're going to make good things happen out of it. And when you lay that argument, or when you lay the rest of Romans 3 over Genesis 27, and when you look through that lens at Genesis 27, at this Rebekah, Isaac, Esau, Jacob narrative, I would say that what you see here is you see a signpost to grace, right? You see a signpost to the new covenant. You see a signpost to that we've all sinned. And in our futile attempts to make things happen, in our futile attempts to get the blessing, in our futile attempts, all this stuff, yet we are now saved and set right by his free gift of grace through Christ, right? I see Genesis 27 as a signpost to this new covenant, right? I see where God's goodness goes far and above our petty failures, all the ways we try to make things happen, all the ways that we think that we're gonna get God, and God says you can lie, you can cheat, you can steal, that doesn't matter. What matters is my grace. People always assume that the church's primary business is to teach morality. It isn't. It's to proclaim grace, forgiveness, and the free party for all. The gospel is not a self-improvement scheme devised by a God who holds back on us until he sees the improvements. Above all, Jesus wants to make sure we understand that he doesn't care a fig about our precious results. It doesn't even make a difference to him if we are solid brass bastards, because while we were still sinners, Christ died for you and for I. And when you see in Genesis, you see, look, if you can make it a moral story and go teach morals, and that's helpful at some points. I don't want to say that that's not helpful at all. But if you look at this story and say, there's not much redemption in these characters. Rebecca lies and she steals and she overrides her husband. And, you know, Jacob's, he would rather watch his brother die than give him a bowl of soup. And you see, it's like, this is just weird. But then you begin to see, oh, that's me and you, right? We lie and we cheat and we steal and we try and make things happen, right? You and I are the ordinary hustlers. We're the crooks. We're the cowards. We're the thieves. That God says, but guess what? You are now saved and set right by my free gift of grace through the redemption available only in Jesus the Anointed. And here we are, right? Here we are, the hustlers, the crooks, the cowards, the thieves. And I read this story. I think if you read this story as an incredible, like, whoa, that is some grace that God gave them there. That is the new covenant, the power of Christ that works in and through them, despite their circumstances, despite their shortcomings, right? At some point, some Pentecostal churches might be saying amen in here. Pentecostal Michael would be here, right? But that's what it is. Isn't that a great story? Because we kind of get to this, if you approach it with morality and do the means justify the ends, you'll forever argue about that. But if you look at it and say, this is a picture of grace, that despite all that they did, God says, I'll still bless you. I'll still bless you. Now let's end here. Let's end in a prayer. And here's what I want to do. Would you guys close your eyes for a second? And we're going to do a little discussion. And maybe you've identified with one of these characters here. Maybe you identified with Jacob or Rebecca, and I blow at God, and I try and push my agenda, and I try and make things happen, and maybe you feel like Esau. You feel like you've been hustled. You feel like you've been cheated in life. And God is still just looking down at you and saying, no, no, no. The free gift of grace that is available through Jesus, the Anointed One, is available to you today. Will you receive it? Will you receive that? And maybe you, in your own way, you just want to talk to the Lord about that and say, Lord, I need your grace. I need your good news. I need your mercy, compassion. And Lord, for my brothers and sisters that have walked in here with, they've walked in here with junk in their hearts. They walked in here as the crook or the coward or the thief or the one who's been slighted or taken advantage of. Would you speak to them and say that you're on their side? That your grace is still that free gift for them. It's still a blessing in their life. That's good news. That all the ways that we try and doctor up our results and make ourselves look better than we are and force the issue, doesn't matter. You died for us right in the middle of our sinfulness, and you hold out your hands with grace and with mercy and with love, and you offer it to us. Thank you, Lord. Thank you. In the name of Christ. Amen.